Well, we've laid the background up to this point in the book of Revelation. We've talked about a lot of the background issues, and these are very important things to establish before we get into the book. I think really with the book of Revelation, it's more important to understand the background of the book and the setting of it and the date and kind of the different views and all of those things really than any other book in the New Testament. And so we've established this idea, at least the framework we're going to look at the book, or the lens we're going to the view it through, is the futurist view, that chapters 4 and following are depicting real persons, real events yet to appear in human history. But when you come to chapters 1 to 3, really commentators pretty much agree on what these chapters are about. So the next couple of lessons here, as we go through chapters 1, 2, and 3, there's pretty much agreement on what these chapters are discussing. And when you get to Revelation chapter 1 and we kind of launch into the book, the first 8 verses are the prologue to the book. And then we begin with the vision, where John is caught up in this visionary state in verse 9. So I want to just look at the prologue here. And again, this will kind of be a little bit more introductory material, but I think, again, this will just help us to kind of really get the foundation laid as we go through the book. We talked about the divine outline of the book is in chapter 1, verse 19. I call this the divinely inspired outline of the book. John is told, write therefore the things you have seen. And the things that he has seen are the events in chapter 1, the resurrected, glorified Christ. The things that are will be chapters 2 and 3. The things after these things, chapter 4 and following. So Revelation 1, 1 through 20 is the things John has just seen. And you'll notice here in chapter 1, I call this the Lordship of Christ, and then chapters 2 and 3, the letters of Christ. So what we have in chapter 1 here is the Lordship of Christ, and this is the prologue in the first 8 verses. Now, the first thing we have in the book is the title of the book, and we talked about this a couple lessons ago, but it's not the Revelations of Jesus Christ. It's singular. So if you don't get anything else out of the whole session together, get down the name of the book. It's Revelation. It's singular. It's the Revelation. And it's not the Revelation of John. It's the Revelation of Jesus Christ. And we said there, we said before that Revelation of Jesus Christ, you could take that two ways. This could be the revelation about Jesus Christ. That is, he is the revealed one, or it could be the revelation of Jesus Christ, that is, the revelation from him, that is, he is the revealer. And I think based on verse 1 here, the emphasis is, it's the revelation from Jesus Christ, because the next words say, which God gave him to show to his bondservants. So Jesus Christ here in this book is the revealer. He's also revealed, but he primarily here is the revealer. Now notice the chain of transmission. We have the title of the book, the revelation of Jesus Christ, and then we have the transmission of the book. There's a chain here of transmission, or a chain of communication. It's the revelation of Jesus Christ, notice, which God gave him, that is Jesus, to show to his bondservants, the things which must shortly take place, and he sent and communicated it by his angel to his servant John. So when you put this together, the chain of communication, it goes from God the Father to Jesus, to an angel, to John, and then to God's other servants or bondservants, which are those who have submitted their lives to Jesus Christ. So notice here, God is where this begins. God is the author of this book. This is a revelation from God given to Jesus Christ. And we dare not miss that. That speaks to us of the authority and the inspiration of this book. It's from God himself. And John believes that the Old Testament is God's word, as he alludes to it so frequently. And he claims that his own message is a divinely inspired, authoritative message from God. So it comes from God, and then it's given to Jesus. And then often we'll see in the book is given to an angel who then communicates the message to John, and then John writes it down and then communicates it to us. So this is the chain of transmission, or the chain of communication of the book here. Now, one of the things we see is Revelation is a picture book. Notice in verse 1, it's the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show to his bondservants. The word show there is a word in Greek that implies it was communicated in visual form. So I like to say that Revelation is a show and tell book. John is seeing these things. They're being shown to him. And he's writing down what he sees. And then, later in verse 1, it says, he sent and communicated it by his angel to his bondservant John. The word communicated there is the word semino in Greek. And it means to communicate by symbols. So this gives us advance notice that this is going to be a symbolic book. And then at the end of verse 2, it says that he bore witness to the word of God and the testimony of Jesus Christ, even to all that he saw. Now, as we go through the book, John is going to hear things as well. He's going to be told things, but primarily John is seeing things. It's communicated in visual form, it's given by symbols, and it's all here that he saw. So John is going to be seeing visions, and he's going to be writing down what he sees. So Revelation is a picture book. Now, that raises the question in the book, why symbols? Why are there so many symbols in the book of Revelation? I have people ask me that all the time when I'm doing radio interviews. They'll say, why didn't God just tell us these things? Just clearly, we have to argue and debate about what these symbols mean. Why did God give this to us in symbolic language? Well, I don't know that we know for sure, but a couple reasons could be. One is that symbolic language is more timeless. It's not weakened by the passing of time, and symbols kind of transcend culture. Also, symbolic language is vivid. It arouses emotion and arouses excitement. It creates powerful mental images. When you read about a beast that's coming up out of the sea with 7 heads and 10 horns, that's a lot more vivid than just kind of describing some individual who's going to rule the world in the future. Also, it's kind of like the old saying we have, a picture speaks 1,000 words. You can look at this picture and it's very graphic and vivid, and it speaks to us, I think, in emotional ways and touches the heartstrings as well as just reaching the mind. So maybe some of the reason why symbols are used here. Now, one of the issues, too, that we need to talk about and kind of get out of the way here up front is, how do we interpret all the symbols in this book? I want to give 3 keys to interpreting symbols, especially the symbols in the book of Revelation. And I want to add this caveat up front. Symbolism is not a license to interpret the Bible however we want. Some people, when they see a symbol, what they do then is they just let their imagination run wild and they just can kind of make it mean whatever they want it to mean. And people have done that often in church history with the book of Revelation. It's like the old poem I heard years ago, "Wonderful things in the Bible I see, especially the things put there by you and by me." And that's what people do. They go and just kind of put things into the Bible and read their meaning into it. The grammar, the historical setting, and the context set the limits for what a symbol can mean. So just because we have symbols doesn't mean we let our imagination run wild. I just mentioned this as kind of a background. In the book of Daniel, which is the Old Testament book of Revelation, it's often called, symbols in the book of Daniel had a literal referent. In other words, a symbol referred to something literal. Let me just give this example. Remember in Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar saw the great image, the great metallic man. The head was gold, the arms and chest were silver, the belly and the thighs were bronze, the feet were the legs were of iron, and the feet were iron and clay mixed. Now, when Daniel goes in to give Nebuchadnezzar the interpretation of the dream, actually he gives him the dream and the interpretation. And he looks at Nebuchadnezzar and said, "You, Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold." So that symbol of the head of gold referred to something literal. It was Nebuchadnezzar and his kingdom. Then he says, after you, there's going to be another kingdom that's inferior to you. We know that the silver typifies or points toward the Persian Empire. So in other words, the symbols there referred to something literal. It's the same thing when we come to the book of Revelation. So let me give you these 3 keys to interpreting symbols. Number 1 is, follow the example of Jesus in Revelation 1. Every symbol has a literal referent. Revelation chapter 1, Jesus stands in the middle of 7 lampstands. We're not left to our imagination of what those lampstands mean. He says, these lampstands are the 7 churches. And he says, the 7 stars in my right hand, these are the 7 messengers of those 7 churches. So Jesus tells us at the very beginning, when you see a symbol, That symbol has a literal referent. So our job as the interpreter is to find out what is the literal referent of that symbol. So how do we do that? Well, first of all, the second point in interpreting symbols is look to the immediate context. At least 46 times in the book of Revelation, symbols are interpreted within the book of Revelation itself. I call this the built-in interpretation. Sometimes you're reading through there and you read and you see a symbol, and in that verse or maybe a few verses later, it actually gives you the interpretation of that symbol. So we're not left to try to figure it out for ourselves. And then the third key would be this. Every symbol has a literal referent. You look to the immediate context, see if it gives you the meaning. If it doesn't, look to the Old Testament for guidance. Many of these symbols that are in the book of Revelation have been used elsewhere in Scripture. Some of them are very common symbols that have been used often in the Old Testament. We go back to the Old Testament kind of as the pool there for us to try to go back and find out what these symbols mean. One of them we'll look at is in Revelation chapter 12, the identity of the woman there in Revelation 12. There's going to be an Old Testament passage that's going to really help us understand that. So that's a little bit of the key to how we want to interpret the symbols here in Revelation. The next thing we see in Revelation chapter 1 are these timing statements. I've referred to these in a couple of the past lessons we've had. In chapter 1, verse 1, it says, "The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show to his bondservants the things which must shortly take place. And he sent and communicated it by his angel to his bondservant John." And then notice the very end of verse 3, it says, "For the time is near." So in chapter 1, verse 1, it says, "These things must shortly take place." It's the Greek word take there. And then in verse 3, it says, "For the time," and that's the Greek word kairos. It doesn't so much refer to chronological time, that the word chronos, but kairos means an appointed time or a season. He's saying the appointed time or season is near. And he uses the word there, the word ingus. Now again, preterists jump on this and they say, well, look, these things are near and they're close. So this has to be something that is coming near on the horizon. Well, there's four different views of these timing statements here. When it says soon and near, some take this to believe, again, the preterists, that it's going to be within a few years. The problem is Revelation wasn't written in 65 AD, so that kind of shoots that view down. Others will say whenever God says these things are going to shortly take place or the time is near, this is looking at time from God's perspective. Because in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 8, it says that with God, 1,000 years is like a day and a day is like 1,000 years. We'll say, well, in God's view of time, it is a short time or it is near. Again, that's possible, but that seems to me kind of an odd way to refer to this here, you know, that it's soon or it's near and it's from God's perspective, because after all, he's writing to human beings. Others will say that the word take there in chapter 1, verse 1, the things that must shortly take place, that word can carry the idea of quickly. In other words, it's not telling us when this will happen, but how it will happen. In other words, whenever these events do happen, it'll be quick or sudden. That is a way you could understand that word. The problem is down in verse 3 when he says the time is near, that word ingus doesn't carry that same idea of suddenly or quickly. It carries the idea more of near. So to me, if you want to put both of these terms together, the view that I hold of these timing statements is they speak of imminency. In other words, not that the events in Revelation are immediate, but they're imminent. They don't have to happen soon. They could happen soon, but they're imminent. And when we talk of imminency in the Bible, what we mean is something that is certain to happen, but it's uncertain as to when it will happen. So something that's certain to happen, but uncertain as to when it will happen. I liken that to the big one out in California. I didn't know much about earthquakes here in Oklahoma. I think now we're second in the nation in earthquakes. We've been having earthquakes all over the place. Most of ours are fairly small, though, which is a good thing. But in California, everybody believes the big one is coming. It's certain there's going to be a massive earthquake someday in California. But it's uncertain as to when it's going to happen. It could happen at any moment. And that's the same way we view imminency and view the events of the book of Revelation. They're certain they will occur, but we're uncertain when they will happen. They could come and break in and happen at any moment of time. That's the way I understand these words, take and ingus here. These are things, they're shortly, they're near. These are things that could break in at any point in time. Think about in 1 John. Remember in 1 John, John says, little children, it's the last hour. Well, the last hour has been going on now for 2,000 years. Again, that's speaking of this idea that these things could happen at any time. Christ could begin to bring these events to pass. The next thing we see here in our exposition here of Revelation 1 is verse 3, a great verse, one of the key verses in the book. Blessed is he who reads, those who hear the words of the prophecy and heed the things which are written in it, for the time is near. This is the first of seven Beatitudes in the book of Revelation. Blessed is the one who reads, those who hear the words of the prophecy. Seven of these Beatitudes throughout the book. And this tells us the book of Revelation is not a burdensome book. It's a blessed book. A lot of people look at the book of Revelation as kind of a burdensome book. And I said this once before, but the book of Revelation is not a depressant. It's a stimulant. It's to stimulate us to live for the Lord. It's really the blessing book of the New Testament. And one of the things this tells me here is the book of Revelation is meant to be understood. One of the complaints we often hear about the book of Revelation is people will say, well, you can't understand it. It's so hard to understand. Two things tell us it's supposed to be understood. One is the title of the book. It's called The Apocalypse of Jesus Christ. That word apocalypse means the unveiling or taking the cover off of something. The book of Revelation is not the covering or the hiding or the veiling of this truth. It's the uncovering of it. If it's meant to uncover the future, then we must be able to understand it. And also, if this book is to bless our lives, we must be able to understand it. It says, blessed are those who read it, who hear it, and who do what's stated in it. We must be able to understand it to obey what's written in this book. So to me, it's meant to be understood. Back in the beginning of this book, chapter 1, verse 3, it's a blessing on those who read it. And all the way in chapter 22, verse 7, the very end of the book, there's also a blessing that's stated there. Revelation chapter 22, verse 7, behold, I'm come quickly. Blessed is he who heeds the words of the prophecy of this book. So it's like bookends or brackets. This is a blessing book. And so I always like to tell people when we study the book of Revelation, get ready to be blessed. And I pray that God will bless you in your study of this. And you say, well, how's God going to bless me? Well, one of the ways he blesses us in studying this book is we come to know the mind of God about the future. And there's a great blessing in that. I always like to go back to Abraham. You remember that whenever God was going to destroy the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, he came and told Abraham what he was going to do. Abraham wasn't going to be there, but yet he came and showed Abraham and told him what he was going to do. And I like the way one of my old professors used to say it. He says, God came and took Abraham into his confidence, and he shared his heart with him and told him what he was going to do. I mean, that's what I see of us as God's people. I don't think we're going to be here on earth when these events of the tribulation are being poured out. People say, well, why is God telling us all this stuff if we're not going to be here? Why did he tell Abraham all about Sodom and Gomorrah if he wasn't going to be there? Because what does he say? God says, shall not I disclose to my friend a thing which I'm about to do? We're God's friends. God wants us to know the future. And there's a blessing in knowing what's coming in this world. Look, there's a heartache in knowing that too in some ways. But it's a blessing to know what God will do. One other thing about this verse here, a couple things. This is the beginning of a whole bunch of triplets. John loves to speak in triplets. He says, the one who reads, the one who hears, and the one who obeys the things written here. We're going to see throughout the book here, especially in this first part, he loves to speak here in triplets. So we'll see that often. And also the three words here are all in the present tense. He says, the one who reads, the one who hears, and the one who pays attention to or watches over these things or keeps his eye on these things. They're all in the present tense. The idea is the one who reads continuously, the one who hears, the one who obeys these things continuously. When he says, blessed is the one who reads, we have to put this back in the original context of this book, because everybody didn't have a copy of the Bible like we do now. They didn't have a copy of Revelation. So this would have been written on a scroll, probably about, many believe, about 15 feet long, a papyrus scroll. And this would be read by someone. He's saying there's a blessing on the person who reads this. So it'd be read aloud there in church. They're blessed. Blessed are those who hear it, who sit there in church and hear this book read to them. And then, most importantly, maybe, blessed is the one who pays attention to and watches and keeps his eye on these things. Because remember, ultimately, all prophecy is morally directed. Prophecy is not just given to us so we can make up timelines and have sensational type ideas, or people trying to set dates for the future, or foolish things like that. All prophecy ultimately is morally directed. It's meant to change our lives. It's the one who hears these things, the one who reads it, the one who heeds these things and does what's written in them. So Revelation is a picture book. It's a profitable book. And it's a prophecy book. It calls itself a prophecy five times. You see that here in verse 3. Blessed is the one who reads, those who hear the words of the prophecy. So above everything else, the book of Revelation is a prophecy. It's telling us about the future. We said at the introduction, it's a prophecy written in the form of an epistle or a letter that contains apocalyptic imagery. One other thing here I like, back up in verse 1. Let me read this again and just emphasize this. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show to his bondservants, notice, the things which must shortly take place. There's a certainty about these events in the book of Revelation. They must happen. There's no doubt about it. There's no hedging on this, whether these things are going to take place or not. God showed John things that must happen. So the events of the book of Revelation are a certainty. Well, before we get into verse 4, I think we'll stop here. I said we were going to cover the prologue. Actually, we just covered the first three verses of the prologue. We'll pick up next time with verses 4 through the end of this first chapter. But again, these initial points about this book are very important for us to get in mind. But again, remember about this book of Revelation, it's a picture book. John's going to be seeing visions and writing what he sees. It's a profitable book. It's a blessing book for those who read it and who study it. And it's a prophecy book. It's going to tell us about things that must come to pass in the future.